You know, I think the fear that I have, and I've gotten this from our interviews with people like Mike Dunn, is both federal agencies and federal law enforcement being targeted. They are a particular target for people in these militia and militant anti-government groups. As well, I think there's a real concern with state level and county level officials being targeted, particularly in states that maybe have more serious COVID restrictions. I think that's the thing we saw in Michigan with the kidnapping plot there against the governor, particularly in states where they may be moving to enact some forms of slightly more aggressive gun control laws. Those are the concerns I think that we should all have. And that's what's been articulated to us is like, look, it's not just that we're targeting the federal government, we're targeting everybody.
AC Thompson, we want to thank you for being with us. PBS Frontline correspondent, ProPublica reporter, and Rick Rowley, Oscar-nominated, Emmy-winning filmmaker, just released American Insurrection, a new Frontline documentary now streaming at PBS.org. That does it for our show. We have a job opening of a senior video producer, senior news producer to join our team here in New York City. Learn more and apply at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe. Wear a mask.
This is KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing, unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 5 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
This is KBOO Portland. It's Wednesday. It's 8:01 a.m. Coming up is the Wednesday Talk Radio program with Paul Rowland and Jacqueline Keeler. Meanwhile, KBOO Community Radio would like to thank Wyeth and Valerie, Leslie, Kevin, and Deborah for all contributing to the spring membership drive. We do, of course, have to do things a little differently this time. The way these folks did it was, well, they may have gone to kboo.fm/give, spelled G-I-V-E, of course. Or maybe they texted KBOO to the number 44321. However they did it, they done did it, and you can too. Think about it, won't you? Now stay tuned for Wednesday Talk Radio on KBOO Portland, your community connection.
Hold your head up, lift the top of your mind, put your eyes on the earth, lift your heart.
And good morning, everybody. This is your regular Wednesday Talk Radio host, Paul Rowland. Shortly, we'll bringing up my second Wednesday co-host, Jacqueline Keeler, who is a Dene Ihotanwan Dakota writer living here in Portland. She is editor of the anthology Edge of Morning, Native voices speak for the bear's ears and has contributed to many publications, including The Nation, Yes Magazine, and Salon. And she's the author of the just-out, hotly anticipated standoff, Standing Rock, The Bundy Movement, and the American Story of Sacred Lands, which is one of the things we will be talking about this morning. I just wanted to apologize for not showing up last week. I re-injured an old back injury and was having a really hard time sitting for any length of time, which, anyway, created some difficulties. So I'm getting better, and I'm back. And I'm really glad to be here at our spring membership drive, which I hope is going well, and I hope will be going even better as you take the time and effort to, as Sonia just said, go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. So, yeah, 5 years ago, the Building Resistance Against the Dakota Access Pipeline in North Dakota exploded into an unprecedented series of encampments near the Cannonball River on the Standing Rock Dakota Sioux Reservation, while Trump famously reversed the belated Obama decision to halt construction over contested Army Corps of Engineers permits. The project had been allowed to go forward under Obama. Now, another Democratic administration with Joe Biden is allowing the pipeline to continue, despite the ongoing threats it poses to the Standing Rock Sioux tribe and the environment, and the fact that it is operating without a federal permit. That will be one of the major themes, but we're going to be talking more generally about the Biden administration and how it is confronting both the issue of tribal sovereignty and treaty rights and the dire threat posed by the fossil fuel industry. So good morning, Jackie.
Good morning, Paul.
Hi. So I hope you're excited about your book coming out.
Yeah, I am. It's been really amazing. It's different this time around with COVID and doing it a lot of it virtually. So, but it's been really exciting.
Yeah. Would you you have some really great blurbs? Would you mind if I just read the one by Louise Erdrich?
Yeah. Sure.
Okay. Louise Erdrich, who herself is a very well-known Native author, rigorous analysis and personal storytelling invigorate Jacqueline Keeler's examination of Indigenous versus colonial land tenure. Standoff recounts the historic legacy of treaty rights and sacred space underpinning Standing Rock's case against the Dakota Access Pipeline, and contrasts this legacy with the white entitlement as well as cultural land desecrations of the Bundy movement, which we know so well from here in Oregon. Standoff is a powerful, illuminating book. That must feel nice. So take us back to the as we come up to the very recent non-decision to just allow this yet another intrusion into tribal lands and desecration of the environment, the Dakota Access Pipeline, to go forward under the Biden administration. Take us back to 5 years ago. When did you first, you may have even heard about the Dakota Access Pipeline well before that. Set the stage.
Yeah, so the camp was started on April 1st, 2016. And I was working on my book, Edge of Morning, and I was interviewing, one of the chapters is an interview I did with my dad's cousin, Faith Spot Eagle, who was really leading the fight against the Keystone XL pipeline, which I also covered as a journalist, and particularly for Indian Country Today. And then I attended a lot of the Public Utility Commission meetings in South Dakota, and so I interviewed her about that because one of the things I wanted to look at with the issue of the Bears Ears National Monument, which is also an issue that's back on the table again. With the Biden administration and the appointment, the confirmation of Deb Haaland as the Interior Secretary, a Native woman. The book, Edge of Morning, is divided up into three parts. And part of it is I wanted a chance for other sacred lands activists, indigenous activists from across the country to comment on the national monument sort of strategy utilized by the five tribes there in the Southwest to protect the Bears Ears area, and then also to discuss their own sites and strategies they use to protect sacred lands. And in the case of pipelines, of course, to protect protect women with the issue of the with the violence against women and other members of the tribe that occur with the man camps and the building of the pipeline.
Mm-hmm.
So I did. So when I was interviewing her for that chapter, she brought that up, the Dakota Access Pipeline, and how concerned she was that the the Army Corps of Engineers had permitted the building of the pipeline under the Missouri River, and so which would then endanger the water supplies of both the tribe and millions of people downstream. And so that's when I first heard about it, was in early 2016, and then I wrote my first article about it really in August of 2016. I actually interviewed, it was for Yes Magazine, I think, in Yes Magazine, and I had interviewed LaDonna Brave Bull Allard, who was the who co-founded the first camp there, the Sacred Stone Camp, and so that was my interviewing her was my first, you know, real coverage of it outside of the mention in Edge of Morning.
And of course, we did hear, Reese, that LaDonna Brave Bull Allard, who was a Standing Rock Historic Preservation Officer, as well as founding that seminal first resistance camp, she recently died. It's a very strange timing with this whole issue coming back around. She definitely deserves an immense amount of credit and honor for that courageous stand on which she founded, I guess, on her family land.
Yeah. She, I had interviewed her, and then I was actually contacted by relatives of mine who were at the camp, and they explained to me that her camp was a separate one from the main camp, which was the Ocheti Shekowin camp, and so then I went out there, but I just it was what I wanted to outline in Standoff, you know, was the coverage that I had done over the 2016, starting in January, covering the Bundy, you know, Ammon and Ryan Bundy and their followers take over of the Malheur Wildlife Refuge here in Oregon, and then ending it in December of 2016 at Standing Rock. With Standing Rock, I really wanted to give attention to a lot of the folks who really did, who began the issue on the reservation, but did not get a lot of attention afterwards. And that would be the fight against the Dakota Access Pipeline really began in McLaughlin, South Dakota, which is in an entirely different part of the reservation on the South Dakota side, and began with a group of a young man, Jonathan Edwards, and other young parents who really inspired the rest of the tribe, particularly young people, to do the runs and everything. And then later, LaDonna got involved because they started in the southern part of the reservation holding meetings, and they gradually moved northward. And then by the fifth or sixth meeting, then she attended and then became involved. And I don't know if she had an official position with the historic. She had a kind of her brother had made her a job at the tribe when he was chairman. And so I'm not sure what her actual, look at what her actual title was. She was so well spoken. I loved quoting her. And I found her framing of the issue so really compelling. You know, talking about, I think you look at the article I wrote then. I think I went back then when I did a Coast show with you, and I think we might have had her on the show at that point, had her call in, and when I was interviewing her then. But yeah, it was, I found it very compelling and very a great way to draw attention. I think later, as I detail in the book, I had issues with how the money was handled and was raised, and so there has never been a real accounting of the millions that were raised.
I think I actually interviewed her, trying to look it up here. I guess as a not so much tooting my own horn, but tooting the horn of independent community media, you know, like the kind that you're involved in and that KBOO has been standing so strong over its 50 plus years here. But I interviewed her on August 17th, 2016 on this talk show. And I think that was one of the early times that, she and the indigenous voices got, it certainly wasn't the first, but it was one of the, it sort of helped open up the issue, I think, and then eventually Amy Goodman interviewed her, and I think something that people don't understand about, the kind of work you do, the kind of work we do here on KBOO, is that, in addition to, you're by now a well-known author and activist in Indian country, so your voice stands alone. But just the idea of breaking stories into the media and then other people picking it up, I think, is a really important function of independent media. I guess is the point I was making, which is important in this spring membership drive, just to reinforce to people, what KBOO is all about and why people need to support us. Go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 443-221. We'll be mentioning that again. It's kind of a extended spring membership drive, somewhat less intrusive. We don't are not able to have the phone bank set up at the station. We're still not having people actually volunteers come into the station. So this is a different format, but I think it's working out pretty well. And you, the listener, are the ones who can make it work out even better. So we've been talking about the origins of Standing Rock resistance, and talking about LaDonna Brave Bull Allard. So what were the issues at stake specifically for the Standing Rock? The main one, obviously, there's others. The closeness of the pipeline to the reservation in general, but specifically, it was going under the Missouri River. So, leading up to talking about the recent decision to allow it to continue without a permit, talk a little bit more about the whole role of the Army Corps of Engineers in permitting the project and that crucial Missouri River crossing and all the politics around that regarding tribal sovereignty.
Yeah. And I think that I was the one that got you the interview with LaDonna, because I had interviewed her already and I encouraged her to go on the show. And actually I'm posting a link to that interview that's actually on the KBOO website to Twitter, if anybody wants to see that and listen to the late LaDonna Allard and her words, and so about early on in the protest. With the issue of with the role of the Army Corps of Engineers, which I think is relevant now because of their recent decision to allow the Biden administration's recent decision, which was issued by the Army Corps of Engineers, to allow the continued flow of oil through the Dakota Access Pipeline, is really concerning. And as you noted, it's sort of the what we're looking at today in the show. Will the Biden administration actually challenge the fossil fuel industry? Will they waffle really the way I feel the Obama administration did, as you noted, taking a very late in the game, finally pulling the permit for the pipeline, as thousands of veterans, U.S. military veterans, came to protect the water protectors, finally pulling the permit and kind of bring a conclusion in early December of 2016 to the standoff at the Unlock. And so here we have the Biden administration, and they had promised, I think the chairman of the tribe, Standing Rock Tribe, Mike Faith, had issued a statement saying that he had been told that they would try to make this right, but that this decision to continue to let the oil flow without a permit, Judge Boasberg had pulled their permit already in the courts, and so the pipeline is now operating without a permit at all, and so this is very concerning. So with the Army Corps of Engineers, I had gotten a lot of insight, and I do detail this in the book Standoff, about the attempts by my dad's tribe, the Yankton Sioux Tribe, which attempted to contact the Colonel Henderson, who was head of the Omaha office of the Army Corps of Engineers, and to request a consultation on the Dakota Access Pipeline, a formal consultation, which is allowed under the treaties that we've signed with the United States that have been ratified by the U.S. Senate. And the Army Corps claims the Missouri River, even though the treaty itself, the treaty goes to the eastern side of the Missouri River, the Fort Laramie Treaty, and so it technically that the crossing should be under the jurisdiction of the Great Sioux Nation, which is all of our different Dakota Lakota tribes and reservations all together. We are the Great Sioux Nation, and so the Army Corps had claimed it because they had created Lake Oahu. They had dammed the river and created a man-made lake, and then so they had in the 50s and had claimed the ownership of that area much later after the treaty was signed. And so, but the inability to get a real consultation, to get a sit-down consultation, a meaningful consultation where they are heard or listened to, was the problem. And so the Yankton Sioux Tribe actually tracked down Colonel Henderson and in person gave him their letter requesting consultation. And then he finally came to visit to have a consultation, but he left really fast. He was insulted because an elderly woman in the tribe took issue with his uniform. He insisted on meeting at buildings that belonged to the Army Corps of Engineers. He would not meet in a tribal office or building. And so he met with the tribe at a fort, a former site of Fort Randall. And she was talking about the trauma and of that fort that occurred there for tribal members, and the fact that he came wearing a uniform. And then he took issue with that and immediately slammed his binder, I guess, and left like within 30 minutes. And so it was supposed to be a 2-hour consultation, but it did not occur. So the tribe refused to acknowledge that as a true consultation, but as a pre-consultation. And so this is sort of the nature of what was going on building up to the actual standoff. But there was, there was a lack of consultation. They were being treated in a way that was really disrespectful by the Army Corps of Engineers, head of the Army Corps of Engineers at the time, from that office. And that the way the pipeline was being permitted, which was in these sort of segmented ways, and without a look at the larger picture, what was going on. So it was a real fight, and so I do detail a lot of that. What I really look at in Standoff as well is the nature of the sovereignty of the Great Sioux Nation, and I feel like, even with our allies, often the issue of sovereignty was not really explained very well to supporters. Looking at particularly at the email sent out by folks like 360.org or 350.org, yes, and where they sort of began to, I noticed that they were basically eliminating mention of the treaties and sovereignty in their emails to their followers and members and donors, and I felt they missed a chance to really educate about the issue of sovereignty and what that means. Native nations of the United States are more than just, you know, these aren't, you know, this is not a club. This is not just, you know, we are nations within the United States, and these treaties, you know, of course, as I point out, often treaties are only entered into by sovereign nations under international law. You know, it's not, the U.S. doesn't sign treaties with groups of citizens, you know, of their own country. They sign treaties with other sovereign nations, and the treaties with the Fort Laramie treaties, those were both ratified by the U.S. Senate. So it is the supreme law of the land according to the Constitution, and it is also international law. So it has quite a standing, and so demanding consultation, which was really the mildest way of invoking the treaty, should not have been such a big deal, and should not have led to the sheriff of Morton County leading basically a militarized assault on the Standing Rock Sioux tribe for all the world to see. I think it showed, you know, I often say that Standing Rock made the occupation, the military occupation of Indian lands, visible to the public. Morton County is also part of the land that was never ceded by the Great Sioux Nation to the United States. It is itself occupied in defiance of international law, and the sheriff of that county, reacted in a way that really demonstrated that they had no respect for Native nations, or even acknowledged no knowledge that they are illegally occupying that land.
Yeah, I want to go back to that episode that you're, where was it, Henderson, the Army Corps of Engineer general, I guess, who went there, and the tying together what you're talking about, the historic and continued military occupation. And I just find it really interesting. I was thinking about this before, but you're mentioning that episode really brought it back, that the multiple agencies that have jurisdictions over these pipelines, you know, Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, the Corps of Engineers, other agencies, EPA, obviously, and state agencies, but the fact that in a way the Interior Department kind of grew out of what was first the War Department, you know, in the early days of the military occupations of indigenous lands and the treaty process and the sort of the vast takeover of indigenous lands and putting them and needing to put them under some department, and so they created the Interior Department. But it kind of grew out of the War Department, and the fact that the Bureau of Indian Affairs is still under it also relates to that. Anyway, I just wanted to bring that up if you want to comment on that, but also just briefly I think it's important that we're talking about the pipelines, the way pipelines are permitted, both as in segments and because they don't look at the pipeline as a whole and say the overall environmental impact and the climate impact. They look at, you know, mile sections or whatever, and they permit, or several mile sections, they permit them in individually, which allows these projects to go without really serious environmental review. And they're also permitted as public utilities. So anyway, those are all things that, you know, the Biden administration, with its many, many challenges, is a challenge to it in how it's going to deal with these questions of Native sovereignty and these big questions of pipelines which relate to it.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's as far as with the Biden administration, it's quite interesting to see what will happen. What Interior Secretary Holland will do. She is a member of the Laguna Pueblo and also a former congresswoman from New Mexico, one of two first Native women to be in Congress, U.S. Congress, and so it's really fascinating. She's a Native woman who has the Department of Interior. She's in charge of pretty much all the public lands in the U.S. and so well, about 75% of the federal public land is managed by her department. And this is the first time a Native woman has been in charge of such a large area in the United States, obviously. And of course, one of the, she is in charge of even the Department of Homeland Security, or the different Homeland Security aspects, and all the dams in the country, everything. And it's going to be fascinating how she utilizes that power. I haven't heard her. Of course, she has also said, as well as other politicians and have come to the fore in U.S. politics since Standing Rock, that she was inspired and went to Standing Rock, like AOC. And so it'll be interesting to see how she acts on this or promotes any sort of change. So, but she has spoken out about Bears Ears. She visited Bears Ears recently, and also about Chaco Canyon as well, and the fracking there. And so, but yeah, it'll be very interesting to see how that plays out. But with the Army Corps, of course, the history with the Army Corps is it's been an overt tool to basically destroy Native claims to lands and water. With the building of dams on the Missouri River that occurred in the mid 20th century, it was a way in which Native farmers, all the tribes along the Missouri River had been forced to take up farming in the 1860s and 70s and onward, and then in the 1940s and 50s and 60s. They saw their best farmland put underwater by these dams that were built along the Missouri River. And so even the town of Cannonball, which was near the actual camp, the Ochetti Shikoan camp and the Sacred Stone camps at Standing Rock, it was moved because its original site had been flooded by the building of the dams. And so I should say, full disclosure, my family's land, my father's family's land was also flooded by the building of these dams on the Missouri River. And it was quite a traumatic thing. It really hollowed out these the sort of progress that had been made in these communities to rebuild themselves and really damage these tribes, and also as you see with what happened with the Fort Laramie Treaty and the claim to the crossing of the Missouri River, that it's been eliminated that aspect of the treaty.
Yeah, so
the Army Corps has not been really a friend. Anyway.
Of course, we know that all too well in the Northwest as well, with the massive dam building activity and the flooding of many village and sacred sites and fishing spots. I just wanted to, I can't help but notice, to refer to the saying that she's Deb Haaland is in charge of Homeland Security. I'm sure you've seen those t-shirts. Was it Defending Homeland Security Since 1492 with the Native Warriors on it?
That's
kind of be interesting how she plays. I mean, it's just so interesting that how all this is going to play out with her in that role.
Yeah. I should say she's she's involved in certain aspects, though, not the entire. But yeah, with the Army Corps of Engineers, I detail an earlier camp that had occurred. And it had occurred on the Yankton Sioux Reservation, and actually it had to do with the community that my family belonged to that was flooded, and it was led by Faith Spadigal. There was an encampment around 2000, 2001 that they had, the Army Corps had lowered the level of the water behind the dam at Fort Randall, and when they lowered the level of the water, a bunch of graves came up. And it turned out that the Army Corps of Engineers had not moved the graves, all of the graves, and so that some of my grandmother's family were still there under the lake, out, their bodies had not been moved with the church. And and so it was very traumatic to the community. And so they put a camp there, and they remained there until, you know, something was done about it. And my grandmother was part of that encampment, and she actually was, you know, they kind of threatened to arrest her and some of the other grandmothers there, this is a long, we've been, you know, these sorts of standoffs that tribes have been utilizing have been happening for a while. I mean, that's 20 years ago, you know, and so it's been a continuing thing. I contrast in the book Standoff, of which I don't know if you mentioned that the my Torrey House Press, my publisher, has agreed to donate 5 copies of Standoff for this membership drive.
And, either as an e-book or as a hard copy, right?
Yes, yeah. And so they can choose which one they want to donate, they want to have. And so and definitely specify what e-book format you would like. The issue is that how these different standoffs, how they were treated by the sheriff, the respective sheriffs of these counties, and by the U.S. government, how responsive they were, and so I think that it was very striking to see the way in which, at Malheur, at the Malheur Wildlife Refuge, the Bundys were allowed to come and go as they pleased. You know, meanwhile, the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe basically faced sort of a embargo. I mean, they were, there was a checkpoint put in front of the reservation, basically blocking, entry. Everyone had to be checked by the National Guard, which was manned by the National Guard, you know, which reported to the president, and acted as sort of a form of, you really harmed the economy of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe. I think that they lost, I think, several $1 million that year, and continue to lose it. And so it has a huge impact for the tribe. But the militarized response was much more extreme with the response to the tribe's demands for consultation than for the armed takeover of the Malheur Wildlife Refuge by the Bundys. And when I first interviewed the Burns Paiute tribal leader, she was, you know, she told me flat out that if they had done that, if the Burns Paiute tribe, with which the Malheur Wildlife Refuge was a remnant of their original reservation, the Malheur Indian Reservation, they would have been, she felt they would have been shot, you know, they would not have been able to do that. And so I often point out that this obsession with using guns by folks like the Bundys is really, I see it, obviously it would be useless against the full force of the U.S. military, right? But what it does do is it's a form of checkmate. They're basically holding themselves hostage and their whiteness hostage. They're testing the limits of their white privilege, right, with the colonial government, of which, you know, they are, I make a point that this is a colonial government, and that the Bundys were evoking their rights and the rights of the Hammond family here as the ranchers in Oregon, that they were fighting for, and out here, that they are invoking their rights as colonists and their rights to the spoils that the colony has obtained through the occupation of indigenous homelands, right? And so, I think it's quite, I don't know, I do a lot of background research in the book, comparing the histories of the Bundy family and their follower ancient and white America to that of the Great Sioux Nation, and I look at a lot of it through the lens of my grandmother's family, the Delorias, and their writings. So I sort of felt like I would do a family to family comparison of philosophy and history between the Bundys and. And they do sort of have a book. They have a scrapbook, which they call the Book of Nay, which has a bunch of quotations that they've culled from many sources, like the Constitution, the Bible, the Book of Mormon, the Doctrine and Covenants of the LDS Church, these sorts of things that they put together as sort of a statement of their ideology and their belief, and how it pertains to their rights to the land. And I compare that to the writings of my dad's family, the Delorias. My that side of my family, another parts of my family, even the Keeler and Bordeaux side, they are Dakota and Lakota people who have been writing for over 100 years and discussing the situation, the political situation that the Dakota and Lakota people have faced vis-a-vis the United States, the domination of the United States. And so so I really compare that, and I really look at the historical references, particularly what the Bundys are referencing, the Revolutionary War, the Constitution, I actually, it was really, really interesting. I mean, that's what took the longest time in writing this book, was doing that research and addressing their claims. And of course, their one of the major claims was that the sheriff in the county is the ultimate power in the county. Even in his or her position is higher than that of the president of the United States within the boundaries of the county itself. And this is called the county supremacy ideology, which was really developed go ahead.
Well, let's hold off. We're about 2/3 of the way through the show. Let's take that point up in a few minutes. I just want to reintroduce yourself and myself. I'm Paul Rowland, the regular weekly host of Wednesday Talk Radio here on KBOO Community Radio. And my co-host on the second Wednesday of every month is Jacqueline Keeler, a Dene Dakota writer living here in Portland, who is writes for many different outlets and is the author of the new book that we're talking about, Standoff, Standing Rock, The Bundy Movement, and the American Story of Sacred Lands. And as Jackie said, her publisher, the Torrey House Press, is offering 5 copies, either in ebook or hard copy form, for a $60 minimum donation to KBOO during our spring membership drive. So you can write to membership@kboo.fm. Requesting your copy. You can also just catch me. You can go to the website, kbo.fm, Wednesday Talk Radio, and you can find a link to email me through the website. Or if you aren't on internet, you can call Sonia, our board operator, at 503-231-8187. And that's actually the first time I mentioned that number. And you can call in and join this conversation. We have about 15-20 minutes left, so better call now. Also, we are on our spring membership drive. Go to kboo.fm/give to contribute whatever amount you are able. Please be generous if you are able, or you can text KBOO to 44321. So much to talk about with these ongoing threats, which we're mainly focusing on the Dakota Access Pipeline, but there's constantly many others that you've written about, Jackie, and are ongoing, including the Bear's Ears, Chaco Canyon, and many others right here in the Northwest, which I'll be talking about in the weeks and months to come. 503-231-8187 is the number to call in. And so, yeah, get back to this this county supremacy, this whole, maybe unpack a little bit. I know you've talked about this over the years. I just noticed that it's been another 5-year anniversary for us co-hosting the show, actually. We started right around that time early. I think our first show you were a guest on in fall of 2015. So this has been a real pleasure for me and a learning experience, as I'm sure it's been for our listeners. I hope they appreciate it and express their appreciation. But yeah, you've talked a lot about the whole history of the colonization, the way the treaties, sovereign status sort of got undermined through sort of unilateral moves both by the courts and by Congress of the United States. But this other thing, this county supremacy movement, how does that fit into the whole picture?
Yeah, so it's I analyzing, comparing the two standoffs, right? The Bundy's takeover of Malheur to the takeover at the takeover, actually the standoff at Standing Rock, right, where the water protectors were standing for the water and for the sovereignty of the Great Sioux Nation over its homeland. And what was really noticeable was a difference in the relationship between the sheriff and the folks. And the Bundys, of course, have this. You know, you can watch one of the meetings between the sheriff of Harney County and Ammon Bundy, and it was very respectful, the way these two white men spoke to each other, very something out of, you know, like they're both the good guys in a Western movie or something. And then you contrast that with the treatment of even the chairman at the time, Chairman Dave Archambault, and many of the leadership of the tribe, the way they were treated by the Morton County Sheriff, right, Kirchmeier. And they were, protested peacefully early on in, I think, early August of 2016. And they were actually arrested by the sheriff, including the chairman of the tribe, and they were strip searched, right? Which is a very invasive procedure. And normally, you know, heads of state, which the chairman of a tribe is the head of state of a nation, right? They are not strip searched by sheriffs in nearby jurisdictions in the United States. You know, they enjoy a certain amount of diplomatic immunity, right, from such invasive things. And of course, this is not extended to heads of state of nations within the United States that are being occupied by the United States. But the sheriff thing is very interesting. So what the Bundys were trying to do was to try to get the sheriff to assume their powers that they claimed they had. And they trace this power of the sheriff to Anglo-Saxon history. And basically they claim that in ye olde England, the Anglo-Saxon people had the right to sort of petition their government. They had these rights that were based in common law. And I should say the Bundys are of English-American descent. And I trace the name Bundy to actually an Anglo-Saxon practice where a man could swear an oath of allegiance to a feudal lord and obtain land in exchange. And this was their bound. They were bound to that lord. And that's where the term Bundy comes from.
Oh, my
Although
God.
Later, under Norman rule, when, you know, William the Conqueror came in and got rid of the Anglo-Saxon nobility, he actually wiped out most of the Anglo-Saxon nobility and replaced them with his own friends that came with him from Normandy. And then it actually became serfdom, a form of serfdom, whereby when the lord of the land inherited the land, he inherited the Bundy. They were property, right? And so in most of England, this was the case. And even today, I think a recent report then that came out found that 70% of the land is still owned by these Norman conquerors and their descendants in England. It's pretty extraordinary. I mean, go invade someone's country, and 1,000 years later, you and your friend's descendants still own most of the land, you know.
Similar to what happened when they came here.
Yes. Although, you know,
ironically.
Yeah, and so they have this sort of fanciful version of history, and I do look a bit at the whole issue of the difference between being a colonist and being an indigenous people, and I think I've given that definition before. Do you want me to read a bit of from the book? I could read the introduction.
Yeah, please, and then we do have a caller, so let's hear that and then go to our caller.
Oh, well, let's hear the caller, and then I'll do the reading, so that would be fine.
Okay, well, let's go right to Lee. Go ahead. You are on the air.
Hi, Jackie. Hi, Paul. Lee here. I wonder if you have any comments about what's going on at Thacker Pass in Nevada and the proposed lithium mine that's, you know, just going to destroy, you know, that area. And that area is also part of the traditional lands of some of the Paiute in that area of north central Nevada.
Wow, this is the first I'm hearing of it. I would love to hear more. I'll look into it, definitely. I think it would be, I would definitely love to do more coverage of that as well.
Max Wilbert is, he just had a book published called Bright Green Lies, well, excuse me, The Wrong Direction. He's on Facebook, and I would like to know how I could do more to support it, but, you know, Standing Rock was in, you know, the central part of the continent. Nevada, where Thacker Pass is out in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, we'll look into it. I hope to cover that in the upcoming weeks and months. So thanks for bringing our attention to that, Lee. That's an issue that deals with the whole so-called clean energy and this high reliance on lithium, which is now being mined all over the world at breakneck speed. So it's the latest extractivist industry that the alternative or clean energy industry is dependent on, unfortunately. So it brings up whole other sets of questions, and as Lee brought out, brings up the issue of the of native rights as well. But maybe you could
research that quite a bit more before you comment on it, because I have to see what tribal treaty rights are involved, whether it's public land or private land. If it's public land, then of course Deb Haaland, as the Interior Secretary, would have a great deal to say about it. So I'd be really curious to look at that some more, but I think I would have to do a lot more research before I could comment on it publicly. So
why don't we go back to the reading you were going to do?
Yeah. So this is from my book, Standoff. This is from the introduction. A young man holds a staff on a gray asphalt road surrounded by the prairie. It's October and the grass has turned gold and dry. The bent staff is decorated with eagle feathers. The youth Danny Grassrope of the Kulwichashe Oyate Lower Brule Sioux tribe is wearing a red scarf over his head and beige pants and a t-shirt. The men wrestling with him and the staff are mostly in black uniforms, some in green jackets and beige polyester pants, most wearing riot gear helmets, a few wearing respirators, and all carrying guns in their holsters. His slight figure goes down, but still he hangs on to the staff. In the end, the law enforcement in riot gear take it and pin him down, pressing his face to the soft earth and lashing his wrist behind his back with plastic handcuffs. The Lakota youth that had begun the fight against the Dakota Access Pipeline had carried that staff across the country from North Dakota to Washington, D.C. They had run thousands of miles to request that the Army Corps of Engineers reconsider allowing the crude oil pipeline to be built just a mile north of the sole intake source of water for the reservation. The young man was not just fighting for an object, but for a son, that prayer a new generation was carrying for the future. The staff and other personal items like sacred pipes, chalupas, were later returned to the main Ochetti Shekowin camp north of the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation. They came in plastic bags with numbers on them, matching the numbers that were written on their owner's arms in jail. Elders I spoke to who held a ceremony to bless and cleanse them told me they smelled of urine and had evidently been peed on. How did American citizens end up on either side of the standoff, the police in their armor and the young man armed only with a staff representing the prayers of his people? The scenes of the raid of this 1851 treaty camp near the Dakota Access Pipeline construction corridor on October 28, 2016, did not resemble the post-racial America Obama's administration was supposed to usher in, an America where the lessons of the civil rights movement had been fully integrated into the power structure of the nation by the election of a black man as leader of the free world. Instead, Obama's administration oversaw the violent arrest of 142 water protectors that day. Images of the forceful movement of the camp are haunting. Teepees ripped open by white men in military uniforms, Native people being dragged out of a sweat lodge, These scenes are reminiscent of the 1863 Whitestone massacre that occurred not far from the 1851 treaty camp. Just 9 months later, 9 months earlier, along Lavoie Finicum, an Arizona foster parent, is run off the road by a blockade set up by the Oregon State Police to capture the leaders of the armed takeover of the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge. On the snowy roadside, surrounded by police cars, he gets out of a white SUV with his hands up. He speaks imperiously to the police, giving the impression he expects to be able to have a conversation as equals with them. In the month, the armed occupiers led by Ammon Bundy, son of Scufflaw, Nevada rancher Clive and Bundy, have held the wildlife refuge. They have enjoyed a respectful, if oppositional, relationship with the local county sheriff. They have been free to come and go from the refuge to get supplies or attend speaking engagements like the one they are heading to now, and meeting with the sheriff in the next county and a crowd of about 100 locals. Finicum obviously felt he had the standing to have a talk with those who had guns pointed at him. During an earlier media interview, when asked why he was sitting with a rifle draped across his lap at the refuge, he had said, "You point a gun at me, you know what to expect." Now with police guns pointed at him, he walks across the snow and reaches a few times toward a pocket in his denim jacket. Police later allege he had a gun tucked there. The third time he reaches, he is gunned down, becoming a martyr to the cause of public lands detractors. What are we all fighting for? Are we so different from one another? What are the causes of this American standoff?
Wow, that's great. And that's Jacqueline Keeler reading from her new book, Standoff, Standing Rock, the Bundy Movement, and the American Story of Sacred Lands. You heard it here for the first time on KBOO Community Radio, and you can get your first chance to get your copies, either of an e-book or of the hard copy. And the first five people who contact us by various methods, I guess the quickest way at this point would be to call 503-231-8187, since we're running out of time and there's really no more time to get a guest in anyway. So that's your best bet, 503-231-8187. You can also write membership at kboo.fm. So we'll figure out the first five people who order a copy. That is a minimum $60 donation to this great 50-plus-year-old radio station. And, yeah, we're almost out of time. So let me just read this headline. You alerted me to this, and I linked to it on my program page. This from Earth Justice. Despite promises to listen to tribes and fight climate change, Biden administration allows oil to continue flowing through Dakota Access Pipeline. And, of course, he was vice president of Obama when all that was going down that you just talked about, the drastically different response to the resistance to the pipeline. So what do you think? Will the Biden administration do the right thing or not?
Yeah, that's the question, isn't it? I hope so. I mean, part of the issue that I discuss in the book about the issue of being a colonial government means that the whole structure of the system is meant to be a colonizing and appropriative force. And so the question is, can changing who's in the driver's seat change what happens, right? And I believe it can. I mean, I'm very hopeful about Deb Haaland, although I am concerned about her, as I mentioned, with the kind of pushback she's going to receive, and I think some of it will be violent, you know. But it's I hope so. I mean, but once again, how will they challenge the fossil fuel industry? How will that, what form will that take? It is very disappointing to see that they are still allowing oil to be flowing when they had a chance to do something about it. So.
Indeed, and as I said, the equally big issue as far as pipelines are concerned, kind of the twin issues of native sovereignty, since so many of these pipelines go through ceded territory, even reservation land, through traditional use areas like the Line 3 up in Minnesota, the wild rice areas. They all go through some traditional territory or another. And the other one of how the permitting process is done in terms of looking at the overall cumulative impact of these pipelines, which they've never done. And only, you know, places like Washington State are starting to, in terms of big infrastructure projects, they're looking at the influence of climate change. So I think if he wants to, you know, bring in the Green New Deal or do something about climate change, what better place than these pipelines?
Yeah, it would be great to see that happen. I should know that the wild rice things were actually Dakota. The Ojibwe came and took them from us fairly recently. So it's actually our traditional homeland there as well. So, but yeah, I think it's, and you know, here in the Pacific Northwest, we have the issue of Hanford, which is on a huge scale, much more of a threat to this entire hemisphere than anything else that's going on. And yet it's something that is very hard to get attention to.
And of course, that's a traditional Yakima. They actually took Hanford out of the Yakima Reservation. But that's another issue that we can't go into because we are just out of time. Thank you once again, Jacqueline Keeler. It's been great having you on my show.
Thanks.
And this is Paul Rowland signing off for KBOO Wednesday Talk Radio. Bye, everybody.
Some gravy in your ear. This is Wavy Gravy, Temple of Accumulated Error and Voice of Woodstock, telling you you are listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM. The 90s are the 60s. Standing on your head.